welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Thank you for joining me for another program in the Listen to Older Voices series of programs. I'm Rob Greaves, and this is part two of a three-part program on the life and times of 63-year-old Robert Lloyd. A baby boomer, Robert took us last week on a journey through his early life in Adelaide. Coming from an artistic family, Robert became a drummer in the early 60s, inspired by both jazz greats and the early developing English music scene. Packing up his drums, he came to Melbourne and quickly became immersed in the exciting and quickly developing Oz music scene. Robert gives us a first-hand impression of what it meant to be a musician in the 60s and how music grew and developed as a fresh new generation grows and develops. As the 60s move into the 70s, Robert and his music continue to develop in Melbourne and Sydney, and we move into discovering Robert Lloyd, the writer. Now we pick up with Robert talking about one of his favourite early bands in the 60s, The Shadows.
I thought The Shadows were just brilliant. I still think there's nothing, even the Beatles, I mean, I'm sure no one would agree with me on this, but I just thought The Shadows were, when the Beatles came along, I thought, yeah, the Beatles are okay, but they're not as good as The Shadows. Because The Shadows could really play, you know, like, they were really, really good musicians.
They were.
And like all of them, but it wasn't just like in some bands where like two of them are really great and the others are sort of, you could replace them. It was like everyone in The Shadows, like even the drummer, you know, they were, you know, the whole band were equally brilliant. And they did this great music, which was like a little orchestra, a little four-piece orchestra, you know, and it was just wonderful stuff, you know, and I was totally, and a lot of people came from Adelaide who ended up in bands in Melbourne. We were all Shadows fans, you know, a lot of those bands from that period. So that, I guess that was what, that really, to answer your question, that's a really truthful answer, was The Shadows. Mm. And even now, I think that love of orchestral music and beautiful melodies and some kind of classical and Spanish guitar music, that sort of probably came from there. Yeah, so that's really turned me on. I think later in Melbourne, I was open to all kinds of things. And in fact, in some ways, my way of rebelling was to be the opposite of everybody else. And I think this is just me being cranky. If people were into the Beatles, you know, I'd be checking out the Yardbirds or Manfred Mann, you know, or and so on. You know, the things I loved, I think I remember really, and I still love them, is the music of Miles Davis. Almost like every period of his music, Miles Davis, I thought was like the quintessential cool, you know, gentleman, you know, musician, you know, so on.
It has often been said that if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there. Now, I think that probably relates back to the general assumption that the 60s were full of drugs, and therefore if you're involved in drugs, you wouldn't remember. Mm. But there was more going on than that. So if I talk to you now about what the 60s meant to you, what would you say?
If you say were between the age, say, 16 and 20 when the 60s really hit, it's just the most amazing period in your life because, and I guess for anybody, that age period is quite remarkable, but the 60s represent such amazing change. It meant a lot of things. Like, one thing it meant was Bob Dylan. It meant, for the first time, poetry, you know, and rock got together, got into bed together and created this whole new thing, which really has changed the face of popular music. So it meant that a lot, that it opened this whole thing up. But it's almost like every kind of music was there. Like, there was incredible folk music. There was incredible music that grew out of folk music. There was incredible jazz. Jazz was really alive. You know, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, all that stuff was wonderful. And it also meant freedom. It meant like women, girls were going on the pill, you know, so it meant sexual liberation. Mm. It meant this whole sense of the repression of the 50s was being thrown off because people could then, sexuality was much, you know, much more common. It meant there was, you know, you had access to lots of beautiful women, particularly if you played in a band.
Particularly if you played in a band. I think our parents and certainly the generations before them were led to believe that if you work hard all your life and get a job and work hard, then life will be good later on. Would you agree that for those of us that were growing up in the 60s, as you said, between 16 and 20, that really didn't apply, that we were looking for other things other than working in the for the man?
Yeah, I think our thing was to reject all that stuff and think, no, I'm young, I'm full of energy, I'm full of beans, I'm really talented, I could do all kinds of stuff, so I'll just take a risk, I'll give it a shot, and I'll do what I can do. I was totally into working. I think working is great. You've got to keep working and doing stuff. But the old conditions, I don't think, applied. I think you could really find new ways of doing things. And we saw examples of it. You know, you saw, you know, the Beatles become millionaires. Mm. You saw the Rolling Stones become millionaires. You know, you saw, you know, people like Bob Dylan who were thrown out of hotels, you know, eventually owning hotels.
Indeed. Prior to that, musicians really had been interesting characters, but they were really on the peripheral of society, weren't they?
Yeah.
You know, and all of a sudden they are becoming society. I mean, everything was being built around being a musician then, wasn't it? It was dominant.
It was. It was an incredible time. In some ways, it's possibly, you know, gone back now, like to the 50s, in some ways, the thinking and all that has evolved and it's changed again. But yeah, certainly that did seem to be the case. If you were a musician, dressed like a musician, acted like a musician, had outrageous behaviour, then, you know, you were, you know, lauded. Of course, there was the downside to all that too, and we lost a lot of comrades along the way as well.
It was a very hard life in many ways, wasn't it?
It was, particularly being on the road. I'm not a huge fan of doing lots of touring. I love playing, but I don't do, like, I've done a lot of touring, and after a while, you're really, it's harrowing. And I know a lot of musicians, you know, like me, who don't like doing lots of touring. I'd rather go out for like 3 weeks at a time.
Mm. I was also thinking about the lifestyle itself wasn't that easy. I mean, it might have been enjoyable, but it really was about shared houses, wasn't it? And
it was
about
shared houses.
Very shared resources.
Shared resources and also shared motel rooms with people who had different levels of hygiene than you had.
Yeah.
E.g. the, to me, that's all comes together in the great symbolic visual image of cornflakes with beer poured on them.
Go on, I think you need to enlarge on that one. Tell us about this.
I can't remember exactly where it was. I think it was some motel out at Bathurst or Griffith or somewhere in the New South Wales, you know, kind of countryside after some tour. But of course, you look around and, you know, what's available for breakfast, and there was nothing open. There was, you know, so there was a packet of, you know, cornflakes, and there was some beer left over from last night. So pretty much that was it. And I remember some guy, I was a roadie or, you know, some very large bass player sort of did that, and I thought, my God, what is this?
Is this what it's come down to?
This is what it's come down to, yeah.
This program has had some 660 episodes, so we've spoken to a lot of people about the 60s, and most of them, in fact, the huge majority of them, weren't involved in this almost countercultural side of it, which you, as coming back to being a baby boomer and a musician, was. Therefore, I think it's probably worth us just spending a little bit of time exploring the things that were happening in Melbourne in terms of the opening up of dances and clubs and things, because many of them are now gone into history of memory, and many people wouldn't have even known about them. When I talk to you about the 60s and dances in Melbourne, what comes to your mind?
The things that come to mind, and it's great because a number of books have been written about this now and they're kind of available, but the things I remember are huge big barns, like a place called The Catcher, which used to be down near Spencer Street Station, and they would open at maybe 6 o'clock at night. It would go to 5 o'clock in the morning, and they would have bands like the Twilights and the Campack, the band I was in, and loads of bands. They'd play for an hour on this huge stage. I don't know how many people that fit in there, maybe at least 1,000. And this was big, like every Friday and Saturday night, you know, and people would be, you know, virtually sort of living there. And so the energy was amazing. What was also interesting, there was a really riff-raff element too, you know, but all the places I seem to played at, I don't remember much of that, like punch-ups and all that stuff. I don't remember seeing much of that. We did have that in some gigs we went to. The other places I remember, which were wonderful places, like I can remember like living in Carlton and having a conga drum, and if I was only working on, say, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, I could grab my conga drum, walk from Carlton into the city, go to the Thumping Tum. David Flint, who was our manager with Camp Act, he ran that venue. I could just have conga drum under the arm and say, I'm with the band. And I'd go in, and usually I'd just get a sit-in with the band, and I'd just play. And there were bands like the La-Di-Das, Doug Parkinson in Focus, the Purple Hearts with Lobby Lloyd.
Max Meyer.
Max Meyer and the Meteors. And these were great bands. Mm. They were genuinely, and I think some people don't realise, these bands were absolutely brilliant. They were just the standard of musicianship and the standard of playing. Okay, some of them may not have been writing great original music. They might have been doing a lot of, you know, Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, James Brown, that kind of stuff. But the playing was brilliant, and I learnt a lot by just watching. And so my real agenda was I just wanted to watch other musicians play to see what I could learn. So I was out like every night of the week having my music lesson. And there was a lot more other clubs too. I remember Sebastian's, and there was one called Bertie's that used to be up on near Parliament House. Mm. Amazing bands, and almost every night of the week in Melbourne there'd be stuff on that I could drag my conga drum to and get in for free, because of course, you know, I was living off the money I earned Friday and Saturday night with the band.
Would it be fair to say that was possibly the greatest period for live Australian music?
I don't know whether I'm an expert on this. My guess is it probably was, because we didn't have the distractions, you know, of videos, CDs, DVDs, all the other stuff now that, you know, people can sit at home and consume, you know, via computer and YouTube and so on. But people were going out a lot more. I mean, definitely there was some ugly stuff around. There was, you know, certain degrees of thuggery, and the police were much more brutal and down on people with long hair and so on. But I mean, I've talked to people, and it was the same for me. You could actually go to something in the city, and then you could walk home to Caulfield, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning and, you know, get there safely, that kind of thing. So I think a lot of people were out and about because of the sense of they felt safer, and it was, you know, one big kind of happy family. The downside was probably the, in Melbourne, certainly it was that the rockers versus the sharpies kind of thing, you know, so there'd be, you know, also punch-ups in the street. There was this other side as well. But I think Melbourne's always been reasonably tribal, having just, you know, moved back here a year ago. I'm still seeing that now. I think Melbourne is very tribal, so you belong to, hopefully, you know, three or more different tribes, and you feel, you know, connected and safe within that, you know, within that tribe.
So you cut your teeth in bands like the Roadrunners and the Delta Set,
yeah,
and then you moved into some fairly commercial and certainly a degree of popularity with Camp Act.
It's interesting you say that, because I think maybe I didn't, because what actually happened is Camp Act, I think, and I'm not sure how this all started, so I can't really point the finger at anyone, but what actually happened is Camp Act weren't working enough for me, and I started going to Sydney and working with bands in Sydney, like Phil Jones and the Unknown Blues, I think, and other people. And I'd just go out for the weekend and play and come back. And I came back, I remember one time, and I think I'd been replaced in Camp Act with a guy called Trevor Courtney, and Keith Glass sort of got him in, I think. And it was about, the thing that changed me was the frilly shirts. I drew the line at frilly shirts. like that episode of Jerry Seinfeld, you know, the puffy shirt sort of episode. I was definitely not going to go there. Because I was then focused on playing drums, all my heroes on drum kit were these creative, brilliant creative people like Max Roach, Tony Williams, Elvin Jones, who were great jazz drummers, very creative. They weren't all about just keeping the beat.
Yes.
As music got more and more locked into let's just keep the beat, I got bored and I thought, oh, this is not for me. I've never seen myself as the kind of musician who became a carpet for other people to walk on. And so I got more, I was happy to be in any band where phrasing and interesting rhythms became the thing. So of course the bands that interest me were people like Jimi Hendrix's band, where they, you know, they played in a very creative way. It was like, you know, John Coltrane. You could, yes, see all that influence from jazz. Yes. So, and then I moved to Sydney and I ended up in Phil Jones and the Unknown Blues, who were a very creative band. And then Heart and Soul, who are another, you know, really creative band, playing like Blood, Sweat and Tears and Chicago, that kind of really, it was pop music to some degree, but had elements of jazz and creativity and improvisation in it.
Sydney, the group known as Heart and Soul, and Lazy Life was their song.
Listen to older voices, revisiting through recollections.
So what year are we talking about roughly here? Where are we now?
I think we're 69, 70. 69,
70. Was life difficult or was it fairly easy still?
I think it's really paradoxical here, Rob. I think it's a paradoxical thing because when you're playing and you're in the with the band, and I think most musicians might say this, when you're in the band playing on stage, it's heaven. You know, it's all great. It's like where you always want to be. That's why some people like Bob Dylan have their so-called never-ending tour. They're happy to be on stage every night playing the material. The hard side is making sure you get the money from your, you know, manager, agent, because, you know, you might drive to Brisbane, you know, and you've just got enough money for petrol to get there. You get there and then the manager hasn't got any money to play you, and he says, I'll wait to the end of the week till your residency's finished and I'll give you the money, and then he just wants to give you a check, but you've got to get back to Sydney because you've got a weekend's work there. And so all this, so getting enough money, even if you were working like five nights a week, just getting the money from it often became a big hassle. There's a lot of probably managers and agents out there who have guilty consciences, you know, so those, from the 60s and the 70s.
So those stories that you do read about, even see in movies of individual artists and groups and bands basically getting ripped off, including people like the Beatles, by their management,
yes.
It really is that widespread, or was that widespread?
To me, it was pretty widespread. And it was largely to do with a few things. I think one was this laissez-faire attitude that a lot of musicians had, like, and managers and agents picked up on it. They thought, these guys are having such a great life. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. We're having a great time. We're playing great music. We're having great fun. Why do we care about the money? Because there was this attitude that was around in the 60s, which was all about, well, it's not really about the money, man. You know, it's like, you know, like, yes, hey, that's, yes, you know, peace and love. All these attitudes were around. And I, like a lot of people, kind of fell into that attitude. And it was a bit like, you know, oh, God will provide, or something will provide. And it's an interesting attitude because, you know, it's kind of gone full circle. Because I still, to some degree, have that attitude that positive energy gets a positive sort of, you know, result back. So I still, at some level, still believe that. But we also really needed to tighten the act up. We really needed to have people responsible in the band to learn how to get the money, you know, from the gigs we've done. And eventually, after being, you know, screwed so many times, you'd start taking action yourself, which I did, and got lots of negative feedback from actually even doing that.
How dare you?
Yeah, like, how dare you? Like, one was when I lived in Sydney and I was working in Phil Jones and the Unknown Blues, we were with a manager. We were like almost the number one band in New South Wales in Sydney, yet we were just making it very, you know, like a meager living. And we thought, well, this can't be right. We had the number one record on the charts. So I got the band and I moved them over to two of the guys and me. We went to another guy called Harry Widmer, who was a top manager. He owned a couple of clubs, and I think he was managing Doug Parkinson and Focus and some other people. And so he wanted to take the band on. So I think the next weekend we were flown to Canberra to a big gig and paid like five times as much money as we were getting. And interesting enough, within 2 weeks, Phil Jones, the lead singer, who was the handsome, you know, front man of the band, quit the band and went solo. you know, as they say, the rest is history.
Yes.
So it's kind of, that's sort of what can happen.
It was
so,
almost a two-edged sword, wasn't it?
Yeah, so yes. I learned the lesson that, yes, the whole lead singer and the band thing is a very tricky thing. Bands that survive better, and of course I didn't realise for this for a long time, is groups like Pink Floyd and other bands, the most successful formula was you have a band name, you have a band, everyone goes out and does their solo projects when they get bored with the band.
Come back into
the, and then they come back, yes, and yes, tour the band. And so, yes, groups like the Rolling Stones, yep, Pink Floyd, and so on, even Led Zeppelin, I guess, to some degree.
It's a great, yes, yes.
That's probably a smarter business, because in a way you see, you know, yourself as a corporation, and you know, you and or a business. And I think that's probably a wiser way to do it. You build up a brand name, you know, whatever your brand name might be.
Now, we have explored, and I'm sure we could go further if we had the time. We've explored fairly well Robert Lloyd, the musician in the group.
Mm.
But as the years went on, you started to develop out and move out of that just working in the group.
Yes.
How did this come about that you started doing solo projects and writing poetry? When did this start and how did it come about?
What I think it started to, there was a genesis of it even back in the 60s, because one of the things I did, which got me fired occasionally, was when I played drums, I used to play often in a very creative way. And for some people, that was fine. For other people, they would be like, what's going on back there? And because, you know, a lot of guys would just like it all to be all about, you know, supporting them.
Yes.
But I could do that. I could support them and do my own thing. I think what a lot of people don't realise, who don't play drums or some other instruments, which are supportive instruments, it can get, for me anyway, it get quite boring playing the same kind of groove all night long. So you'd find ways to phrase and make it interesting. So what happened is I, in a way, became a more and more melodic kind of drummer. And so instead of just going doop, doop, bang, doop, doop, bang, I'd be going like doop, doop, bang, doop, boom, boom, boop, boop, doop, doop, bang.
Filling in the spaces.
Filling in the spaces and
to make it move more.
Yeah.
Yeah, and keep it interesting for you.
Yes. And one of the first things that started me moving from being, you know, a drummer, moving into doing other things, I remember what it started with, there was a famous jazz tune called Coming Home Baby. And on the bass riff went doom, 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 doom. little chromatic rundown. And I worked one night with a bass player and it didn't sound right and I didn't know why. And it eventually occurred to me it was double stops in fifths running down the neck. And I thought, ooh, I can do that. I worked out how to play it on a guitar. So I showed the bass player and then he could do it.
Robert continues to share the story of the exploration and development of his career as a songwriter, wordsmith, and composer. The story is beautifully crafted, and we begin to see how one man's vision for himself actually reflects that of a generation. That's next week, the final part of the story of Robert Lloyd on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.